Welcome to Smith & Marks Walk Into a Bar, History of Economics podcast. My name is Scott Scheel, and I am your co-host today, and I am here with Carlos and Jen. They're joining us for today's conversation. How are you guys doing? What's new in Durham there, Jen?
There's a gasoline shortage. Did you hear about this?
Oh, that's right. I heard about that. Well, yeah, it's a gasoline shortage around the country, I guess, because of this hacking or whatever took place
that's
on the pipeline.
That's right.
I don't understand how do you hack a pipeline? Isn't a pipeline a physical thing? How do you?
It's magic.
I don't understand. But yeah, apparently but especially bad in North Carolina for whatever reason. So
yeah, my understanding is I might be making this up about the last time I heard, like 8% of the gas stations here were out.
Really? Is that being reflected in prices, I assume? Or is that because we're at just, like $3.30 a gallon or something here in Arizona, which is pretty high for us.
So I did something very clever at 2 a.m. the night before everybody started running to the gas station. I filled my tank. So I'm good.
Very good. Smart of you. Yes. Well, Carlos, how is everything in France? You're settling in. When do you start the new job? I guess in the beginning of the fall, the next semester?
Yeah, everything is good, Scott. I think we're good on the gasoline here, even though I assume gasoline is much less important for my life here than for you guys in the U.S.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm supposed to start in August. August 1st is when my contract starts, and then classes start in September. So yeah, I still have a few months of temporary unemployment to enjoy. So that's nice. The summer's coming. So
enjoy that. Yeah. Enjoy
it's a good time to be unemployed.
That's right. Well, we are joined today by a very special guest. I have to stop using that phraseology. But our guest today is Manuela Mosca, who is professor of history of economic thought at the University of Salento in Italy. She is the author of Monopoly Power and Competition, The Italian Marginalist Perspective, which was published in 2018 by Edward Elgar. And that book won the 2019 Joseph J. Spengler Book Prize, which is awarded by the History of Economic Society. So it was the best book in 2019. Thank you for joining us, Manuela. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
That's great. Well, we're going to just dive right into some questions about your book. Monopoly Power and Competition discusses the contributions of four Italian economists, who you call the Italian marginalists, their contributions to the development of what eventually became neoclassical economics, especially their significance for the theories of competition and of monopoly market power. So maybe you could start by telling us, who were the Italian marginalists? Who were these four Italian economists that you write about in your book?
Yes, in my book, I deal with four Italian economists, Vilfredo Pareto, Maffeo Pantaleoni, Antonio De Viti De Marco, and Enrico Barone. Three of them were equal in age. They were born in 1857, 58, 59, except Pareto, who was 10 years older. Three of them were, but not the same three, died within a very short time of one another. They died in 1923-24, while De Viti De Marco died in 1943. Schumpeter claimed that the Italian economists of the period between 1880 and 1920 were second to none. Actually, they were leading figures on the international scene, placing Italy at the center of contemporary debates on economic theory. For personal reasons, they were cosmopolitan, and this certainly helped them find a place in the cultural cross-fertilization of the period. They engaged in correspondence with economists throughout the world, and their work was reviewed in the best journals, in which they in turn published articles and reviews. Their textbooks were translated into various languages. So let me recall the main reason for their reputations. Pareto's everlasting fame was due mainly to the concepts of Paretian optimum, of ordinal utility, and to his law of income distribution, and in general to his contributions to the theory of general equilibrium general economic equilibrium. Maffeo Pantaleoni is considered the first economist to have applied the marginalist analysis to public finance in 1883. But then he was the author of a textbook on pure economics in 1889, 1 year before Marshall. And this book led him to be called the Italian Marshall. Moreover, he wrote other very innovative works. Some of them discussed internationally, for example, in 1910 at the meeting of the American Economic Association. The fame of David DeMarco is mainly due to the foundation of public finance as a purely theoretical discipline, as well as his indirect influence on the foundation of public choice. And finally, Barone is known mainly for his contributions to the theory of marginal productivity and the socialist calculation debate.
That's how I know Barone is through his the contribution that appears in the Collectivist Economic Planning, that the anthology that Hayek did in the 30s. I find it interesting that so Schumpeter said, what was the time period that he said that these were the best economists in the world? This was the best. They were the state of the art. What was the time period again?
Before the end of the 19th century, I mean 1880s and 1920s.
That's interesting that he credits the Italians and not the Austrians. I mean, that's his those are his people. That's interesting, very interesting. I don't think I was aware of that. But so let's a little bit more about the Italian marginalists. So what, in your mind, sort of justifies treating them under this heading of Italian marginalists? Do you count that as a school as such, or what was it that unified them?
Yes, one of the focus of my research has been the presentation of the Italian marginalists as a close-knit group. And this group has never been recognized as a distinct intellectual tradition by historiography. The only economic traditions of the period usually are the German school, the Austrian school, the Lausanne school, the Swedish school, or the British marginalists. But I think that they should be considered as a group, as a tradition. They had deep personal ties. For example, Pantaleoni converted Pareto and Barone to economics. David DeMarco and Pantaleoni were brotherly friends. We have a wealth of correspondence between Pareto and Pantaleoni, between Pantaleoni and Barone, between Pantaleoni and De Viti. Three of them, De Viti, De Marco, Pantaleoni and Pareto, in 1890 gave rise together to a memorable series of a prestigious journal, the Giornale degli Economisti. For most of their lives, they were all believers in free market and free trade, and all four were politically very active. They intervened in the political life of Italy, proposing reforms, both in the Giornale degli Economisti, as well as through direct participation. Two were members of parliament, De Viti, De Marco and Pantaleoni, and two tried to get elected, Barone and Pareto. Their period of militancy lasted exactly from the mid-1880s to the arrival of fascism in the years following the First World War. As for their contribution to the theory of market power, it was precisely their frequent intellectual contact and their reciprocal influence that affected the genesis and development of their ideas on this topic. I made an experiment. If you bring together their writings in a single chronological list, you can see that in most cases, very many of their writings were an immediate reaction triggered by previous work of the others. For instance, in economic dynamics, in the static notion of competition, including welfare considerations, in the identification of the different market structure, and of the structural barriers to entry. And finally, in the theory of elite, the four economists clearly developed a common view, building their theories as an enrichment and expansion of ideas previously expressed by the others. For example, as regards the dynamic conception of competition, none of the four economists accepted Varazian tatonnement, believing that it did not explain how equilibrium is actually attained. And therefore, they developed a great deal of space to analyzing the process of adjustment and the friction that slow it down, as well as its consequence in terms of welfare. On this issue, there was not a common view, but they influenced one another, trying out different methods and in many different directions. Therefore, there was not a constant and complete agreement of views, quite the contrary. In the method of theoretical analysis, I found great differences between Barone and Pantaleoni on the one hand, who admired Marshall's partial equilibrium analysis, and Pareto on the other, who exclusively followed Varras' general economic equilibrium. Also, the relation between economics and sociology was very different in the conception of Pareto, for whom the two fields had to remain separate, and for Pantaleoni, who regarded them as intertwined. And their vision of the road to Italian economic development also differed. Barone was in favor of the idea of industrialization of Italy, while De Viti advocated the development of agriculture exports. But in analyzing the cases of disagreement and discussions, my research confirms the idea that the production of scientific knowledge is a collective phenomenon. In this case, it was a collective phenomenon in which discovery and analysis develop thanks to the interaction among scholars. This choral quality, lies the evidence that the group of Italian marginalists should be considered a well-defined intellectual tradition.
So I imagine when you came to this research project, the discovery of all of this correspondence between the four of these men was had to facilitate the work on the project. But I imagine this was correspondence that had not been delved into or used for historical purposes prior to your use of it.
These four economists are so important that a lot of correspondence has already been published. There are three big volumes of correspondence between Pareto and Pantaleoni, but nobody used it nobody make the step to say, this is a tradition, this is a group. We don't have to talk about the Lausanne school. We have to talk about the Italian marginalists.
Gotcha. So another thing that your book does is to address the various meanings of competition and monopoly power and market power that were sort of prominent before the Italian marginalists sort of made their contributions. So competition and monopoly are concepts that have a long history in economics, but there wasn't sort of a unified concept of these things at the time that the Italian marginalists entered the frame. So what were the kind of various meanings of competition and monopoly that were common in the literature prior to their contributions?
My focus is especially on the sources of monopoly power. So in classical thinking, restraints on competition had no importance in the long run. So the monopoly power resulting from competitive strategies was considered by the classical economists to be always present, but continuously threatened by competition, but both actual and potential, except of course in the case of exogenous obstacles. So monopoly in that sense was present in the classical period, but the market power that the firms obtained through strategic behavior was not considered as a problem because it was perpetually threatened. And market power due to exogenous obstacles did not go beyond the horizon of a short run that they judged unimportant. And such idea of competition was valid for the classicals in theory as well as in reality, which means that competition was considered a widespread phenomenon on condition the market was free from legal restraints. That was their focus on legal institutional restraint. Mm. So this optimism is further confirmed by the fact that in their writings, the specific subject of monopoly takes up very little room. And there wasn't an examination of the causes of monopoly power. So this reason directed me towards the age of the marginalists. Because in those years, in the years of the marginalist, faced with the new industrial phenomena, economists tried to understand why in certain markets firms were persistently few. If they should be worried about their growing size, whether one could count on their reciprocal rivalry, or if this was, on the contrary, an advantage. These questions gave rise to a quantity of studies on the subject of market power that was without precedent. In my book, I briefly outline a general picture of the relationship and the reciprocal influences of the Italian marginalist with the generation of economists who spread and consolidated the neoclassical theoretical system, specifically focusing on competition and monopoly power. So I can sum up my outline briefly. When in 1882, Pantaleoni specified all the conditions that had to be fulfilled for perfect competition, that means free entry and exit, perfect information, large number of sellers, and so on, Edgeworth had just recently formulated a similar list. And following up on Cournot, had set out the first duopoly model of price competition with the product homogeneity. This may also have been the reason why it was so clear to Pantaleoni in 1882 that the forms of the market were as the forms of the market were as numerous as the colors of the spectrum. So not only competition and monopoly, but the full spectrum. Edgeworth contributed an article in the Giornale degli Economisti before it came out in English on the very theme of monopoly. And Edgeworth was the one who summed up the theories that led to the definition of natural monopoly, following the contributions of Viti De Marco, Pareto, Barone, and Pantaleoni on the issue. Both Dupuy, Jules Dupuy, and Vic Steed were also known to Pantaleoni. Vic Sell and Vic Steed were both well known to Barone, who had discussed them, their theories, in his article of 1894-95. And Barone was similarly familiar with the full range of mathematical literature of the time, such as the contribution by Launard, the theory of price competition by Auschwitz and Lieben, and the discussion of the dynamic problems generated by Varras, Tatonneman. As for Wigzell, for example, in 1801, he advanced a great deal farther along the path towards defining perfect competition and provided example of imperfect competition due to large overhead costs, joint supply and location. And his result, Wigzell's result, were very similar to those presented by the Italian economist. Strong reciprocal influences are also clearly detectable in the figure of John Bates Clark. The Italian economist interacted with him at a distance on various themes and shared interest. Besides the question of the theory of distribution based on marginal productivity, which linked him to Barone, and beside the fact that the American economist had written a review of Pareto's Cour, there was the issue of trusts. Clark was in 1882 had taken an interest in the in a inadequacy of the principle of competition for his contemporary reality. And therefore he had applied the concept of non-competing groups to the analysis of the combination that were becoming increasingly important. And this theory had a great impact on Pantaleoni. In his articulate analysis of trusts, Pantaleoni agreed with him on the role of potential competition while criticizing his neglect of the consideration of vertical integration. Clark Essentials of Economic Theories of 1907 prompted a response from Pantaleoni in the form of an essay on the issue of economic dynamics. And it was to this essay that John Bates Clark with Patten and Fetten in 1910 devoted a meeting of the American Economic Association. And there is also a link with the American economist Moore, one of the Varras disciples. He traveled to Italy and he met frequently with Pareto, Barone and Pantaleoni. And Moore declared that he had been greatly influenced by the Italian economist. And in fact, his work follows Pareto's line. Another American traveler who met the Italian economist was Irving Fisher. His work was appreciated by all four Italians from the very beginning. But his reference point in Italy was Pantaleoni, whom he held in great esteem. So there was a reciprocal influence and a great difference with the classical thought, but a lot of cross-fertilization in the period, in the marginalist period.
So what were the specific, so there was a lot going on with the Italian marginalists and their interactions with people in Sweden and Britain and the United States and other parts of the world. But what was the exact nature of their specific contributions to the development of these theories? You write that their contributions were rich and innovative. What made them rich and innovative? That's a difficult word for me to pronounce for some reason. Innovative. Sorry.
Innovative. Yes. Thank you. So I can tell you something very briefly, one by one. So in Pantaleoni's intellectual career, there was an initial phase in which he correctly identified all the conditions for a competitive equilibrium. And then there was another one in which he adopted a vision nearer to the so-called dynamic process conception of competition. That is the conception that Schumpeter, Hayek, and modern neo-Austrians have adopted. This latter vision is the one that most closely corresponds to his idea of market power. So in Pantaleoni's view, the power to set prices was always temporary. The minimum efficient scale most of the time was smaller than market demand, so there was no problem. Monopoly, including the few cases of natural monopoly, was full of dynamism. Trusts were always efficient and contestable. The only element that served to generate profits for him was talent, intelligence, genius. This vision made him look to the future with confidence. According to him, competition would overcome all obstacles, sweeping away all resistance. No other policy was needed apart from the condition of having difficult, not easy, condition of having a ruling class that defends competition, perpetuating it, and if necessary, imposing it on society, but also on itself. And this is Pantaleoni. As for Pareto, although universally praised in the literature, his static theory of perfect competition was regarded by its own creator as only a special case. Pareto was more interested in processes of adjustment due to innovations, but also to frictions and delays. The market power of large firms did not concern him. He considered it to be temporary and limited, since he did not believe that in practice they would reach their minimum average cost. So by contrast, he encouraged very small firms to take advantage of returns to scale and to expand. However, with time, he became convinced that trusts actually do have the power to keep prices high. As for Barone, after the excellent formalization of perfectly competitive equilibrium and of the planned economy that made him famous, he devoted his energy to other market structures. It was very clear to him that reality presents a multiplicity of situations, such as provisional equilibrium, firms that innovate, inputs that are temporarily or permanently scarce, monopolies, firms that produce in the downward sloping part of the average cost curve, active or lazy potential competition, large firms that form unstable cartels, and highly turbulent oligopolies. His belief was that it was possible to make a rigorous examination of all these cases using mathematical tools and derive guidelines for economic policy based on the calculation of social welfare. Lastly, David DeMarco's position on the level of economic theory was more nuanced. However, it was not so for economic policy. He was free market oriented, and he repeated that a small number of firms were enough for active competition through innovation and other strategies. He elaborated a very precise theory of market power due to economies of scale, sunk costs, and input scarcity, and tried to identify policies that could rectify the situation. In the end, David DeMarco saw protectionism as the main obstacle to competition.
That's very interesting, especially what you said about Pareto and his kind of skepticism about his own model. I'm curious, did he live long enough to see, you know, Parisian optimality become this kind of key central concept in economics? And what did he think about what did he think about it? And what might he have thought about it if he had lived long enough to see it become this, sort of a key concept?
Pareto had some followers who developed this mathematical part, the mathematical part of his theory. But at the same time, the generation after this generation in Italy was not so mathematical. So there is a sort of bifurcation. Can I say bifurcation?
Yes, right.
So he could see both sides of the story.
That's interesting. So what was happening historically and politically that made this? That made these contributions important? Was it just a matter of, you know, these are economic concepts that had yet to be settled, and the Italian marginalists made important contributions to the settling of these concepts? Or was there some sort of political or historical force driving this interest in competition and monopoly power?
Well, as I said, the four Italian marginalists were very involved in politics. Their political commitment covered a crucial, dramatic period of Italian history. And this period saw the development of the workers' movement and the appearance both of socialist forces and of movements inspired by the democratic Catholicism. The period prior to the First World War, which for Italy began in 1915, witnessed the alternation of governments of conservative and nationalist orientations, with governments aiming at the integration of the working classes into the system through an alliance with moderate factions of socialism. In Italy, these years were marked by the phenomenon of transformism. Transformism is a system of political patronage, a shifting political alliances, and frequent crossing of party lines by parliamentarians. And this transformism was condemned by the four economists despite their difference. Then the war marked the end of this phase and highlighted in rapid succession the culmination of the process of democratization and its dramatic conclusion. The democratization was achieved at the 1919 elections with the introduction of universal male suffrage. And the dramatic conclusion was due to the inability of the political forces to form stable and effective governments in the troubled aftermath of the war, and to cope with the social tensions triggered by the government's failure to keep the promises made during the war. And these tensions were exacerbated by the widespread public belief that in the post-war treaties, the allies had not upheld the pledges that had made to bring Italy into the war on their side. And these years culminated in Mussolini's seizure of power in 1922. And similar phenomena occurred in the same years in other European countries where the attainment of democracy was rapidly followed by its overthrow. As for the situation of economics, the second half of the 19th century was a kind of crossroads for a variety of methodological positions. One controversy took place between classical thought and the German historical school, which applied the historical method to economic research. The members of the German historical school denied the universality of economic laws, rejected any theoretical approach to knowledge, and supported empirical analysis. And at the level of economic policy, they advocated an active role for the government. And this doctrine became the dominant economic paradigm in many European countries before the spread of marginalists. In Italy, at the time of the marginalists, the historicist approach inspired by the German historical school was still dominant. And the works of the Italian marginalists marked a clear turning point in the history of economic thought. And finally, as regards the theory of competition and market power, in the economic history of Italy in that period, there were many circumstances that made economists think about the issue of monopoly power. And these circumstances, initially out of the ordinary, with time became permanent. Before Italian unification in 1861, publications on the topic were very few. The publications that were available were mainly on topics such as patents, the postal service, trade associations. But over the next three decades, they became much more common and concerned themes such as franchises, trade unions, state monopolies, networks, for the first time networks, public utilities, the development of different communication routes and their public or private management, as well as the calculation of the various tariffs. And they also concerned trusts, combinations, cartels, syndicates, coalitions. Analysis of critical new sectors such as telephones, the shipping industry, aviation, and insurance also appeared. And clearly, the thinking on market power advanced hand in hand with the growth of Italian industry and technological transformation. The scale of this contribution was enormous, disproving the widespread idea that the subject of monopoly power was specific to the United States. It is true that in Italy, the size of big companies was not seen as a problem. They were small. However, this did not mean that the Italian economists ignored the issues related to monopoly power. On the contrary, their interest in these issues was a reaction to developments in Europe and the United States. While the rapidly changing nature of Italian industry and the government policies introduced to deal with these changes had also sparked their interest.
That's very interesting. It's especially interesting to realize the similarities in terms of what is happening, you know, across Europe, in the wake of the war, and the you know, whether it's Red Vienna or the Weimar Republic or you know what's happening in Italy, there's a very similar kind of reaction to democracy and unfortunate consequences that follow from that. But so Kia, going back to economic science proper, so after the Italian marginalists kind of leave the scene, this thing called the behemoth called neoclassical economics really kind of rises to the ascendancy. So what were the, or I should maybe ask this a different way, what was the state of what does neoclassical economics say about competition and monopoly power, and how does that relate to the contributions of the Italian marginalists?
I can tell you that the influence of the Italian marginalists on the economic thought of the generations that followed them was remarkable. And I give you some examples. Schumpeter recalls Pareto's position on competition and Pareto's position as a precursor, a forerunner of the modern duopoly theory. And he also critically recalls Pareto on monopoly. And Schumpeter also mentions Pantaleoni's study of industrial combinations and Barone's thoughts on the theory of costs and the supply curve. Pantaleoni's theory of fixed cost also influenced John Morris Clark, and through him, the following theories of competition. Knight, whose exposition of the theory of perfect competition played an important role in the history of thought, seems to owe his notion of equilibrium precisely to Pareto and Barone. Pareto is also mentioned by Chamberlain for having distinguished between acting like a monopolist and acting like a competitor, and again for his contribution to the theory of duopoly. There is also a thread that from Pareto leads to Lerner, to Abba Lerner, via Amoroso. Amoroso was the follower of Pareto that I mentioned before, and to Lerner's famous index to measure market power, even though there is no proof of direct influence. And finally, Stigler and Silos Labini cites Pareto and Pantaleoni on this issue, Pantaleoni especially for the importance of fixed cost. Then, if I have time, I will tell you later that De Viti De Marco inspired an entire area of research, and there is evidence of derivation from his ideas on the subjects of monopolistic power and the regulation of public utilities. So they had influence on the following generation.
Quite the impact, yeah. And there, as you mentioned earlier, there's also Davide DiMarco's influence on Buchanan and public choice.
Exactly. Unfortunately, the complexity of their verbal descriptions, the complexity of their non-formalized theory has been progressively lost.
Right.
As the economists of the later generation took only their analytically rigorous models. So their legacy has been partial and misunderstood. And this is true for all the marginalists of that generation.
Very true. Of course, I would say the same thing for the Austrians. Well, I'm going to hand the microphone over. I'm going to virtually hand the microphone over to Jennifer, who is going to ask some additional questions about some more detailed questions about your book. So go ahead, Jennifer.
Thanks. So this actually is a perfect transition to the next question that I was going to start with, which was, how did the Italian marginalists think about science and scientific progress and how they saw economics as a science? And one of the specific things I had in the back of my mind, and it comes up in the Pantaleoni, is to what extent, say, something like Darwinian themes were present in the way they were thinking. And the reason I'm curious is it seems like they want economics to be, you know, a science of a dynamic system. And so I was wondering if they had specific views on economics qua scientific discipline.
In my book, under the expression of dynamic competition, I included the stability analysis, the innovation imitation process, disequilibrium, strategic behavior, and selection. So selection was debated heavily in those years. The marginalist economists identified the idea of competition as a selective process. This was a vision of the competitive process that was very characteristic and particularly relevant in the intellectual context of the era that I consider in my book. For example, De Viti De Marco often equates competition with selection, the triumph of the most powerful and best organized firm, which knocks out the small sized competitors, or as a hard fought war usually waged by the newcomer against the well-established rival firm. So the dynamic notion of competition is what is interesting in David De Marco is that the dynamic notion of competition is clearly dominant in his political writings, while the static notion is found almost exclusively in his theoretical works. Barone, too, sometimes calls competition as a selection, a war that is declared between individuals and also between nations. Sometimes competition seen as a selection and as a struggle is interwoven with the idea of strategic behavior, in the case of Pareto. He also states that competition is or selection endogenously determines a firm's efficient size. But as you said, the economist who generalized the concept of selection was Pantaleoni, with his universal selectionism. In his first phase, Pantaleoni used the biology to corroborate the hedonist premise of marginalist, according to which the result of pursuing pleasure is self-preservation, okay? As for the case of conflicts between self-preservation and the welfare of the species, Pantaleoni thinks that natural selection eliminates those kinds of egoists whose acts are not conducive to the survival of their species. From the beginning of his second phase in 1898, Pantaleone abandoned static analysis completely and explored beyond the borders of economics. On the one hand, he incorporated categories from sociology and biology in his analysis of economic phenomena. On the other, he applied economic categories to social, historical, and political realities, as in the conference on the concept of strong and weak in economics, conference delivered before the British Economic Association in 1898. His main idea was that the only class capable of recognizing and pursuing the general interest was the small Western educated elite, industrious, innovative, civilized, which history had selected. He thought it was the only one interested in reproducing the condition for selection. So according to Pantaleoni, progress depended on the ability of this elite to defend the social dynamic and transmit its characteristic to the succeeding generation so that selection might continue. So as you can see, Pantaleoni is perfectly in line with the analytical hierarchicalism of his age and with the then widespread conviction of the Anglo-Saxon superiority. Moreover, for him, social mobility was possible for those who accepted competition using their own abilities, but not for the loser who asked to be assisted by the state. He was sort of obsessed by this vision of society. Society had not to violate natural selection by protecting these incapable people. And if persuasion was insufficient, force would have to be used. Coercion had to be used. So in his third phase with the Great War and then with the Soviet Revolution, Pantaleoni's optimistic evolutionism suffered a serious blow, of course. And despite this, he still believed that the laws of nature were social phenomena, the laws of nature prevailed. After the war, Pantaleoni's social Darwinism was associated with nationalism, according to the most frequent use of the expression during these years of war. And in this phase, he adhered to fascism and supported the pro-free market economic policy of its first government. Pantaleoni, like Pareto and Barone, died before the establishment of Mussolini's dictatorship in 1925. So selection was the key to look at reality and also to look at science. And also everything was the outcome of a selection, even the words that you use, the thought that you have. Everything for Pantaleoni is the outcome of a selection. There is an article by Pantaleoni on the history of economic thought. And you can imagine what is his position. His position is that we have the truth today because it's the a process of selection gave us what we have. And no, the theory of the past are, if they are gone, it is because they deserved not to be preserved. You can imagine the position is very typical. So selection acted in every realm. And for them, science, of course, they had a progressive vision of science, of course. Even if, as I said, the war arrived for them as a disprove of their belief. It was hard for them to keep their idea after the war. So there is a Spencer behind Pantaleoni. There is Herbert Spencer behind Pantaleoni. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning also behind Pareto.
I also want to pick up on someone that you mentioned in the introduction of your book very early on. And you cite the French engineer economist Jules Dupuy. And he's come up in our conversation today. And I wasn't familiar with this person at all, but you cite him as someone that influenced you deeply as you were working. And I wanted to know how you were inspired by this figure and maybe tell us a little bit about Dupuy himself, because I'm sure most of us are unfamiliar with him.
Jennifer, with this question, you bring me back to the beginning of my research more than 30 years ago. So Dupuy is where I first encountered the question of the sources of market power when I studied the work of the engineer economist Jules Dupuy. And Jules Dupuy was a French contemporary of Cournot. They never met, but they were contemporary. And he was contemporary also of John Stuart Mill. So he was born in 1804 and died in 1866. And he's well known, especially for two articles on the measurement of utility in public works, written in 1844, 1849. And in this article, entries, he had clearly described some of the causes of market power. So apart from the institutional ones, so in his opinion, it is impossible for a new firm to enter the market of transport networks because the huge size of capital requirement that are not available to more than a very limited number of entrepreneurs. The new firms takes customers away from the monopolist, that is the incumbent that is already there, and the profit will not be enough to cover the fixed costs of both. And also, he says that the first business uses the best conditions, leaving the less favorable ones to the new one. So it is hard to compete, not because the state gives patent or some institutional privilege to someone, but because there are technical reasons why it is impossible to enter a market. So this analysis made me wonder where I could find a history of the ideas on the sources of monopoly power, market power. How did the economist of the past explain the monopoly power? And many years later, I turned out that I realized that this history coincides with that of the theory of barriers to entry. Okay, so the causes of market power are the same as a barrier to entry, but the history of barrier to entry starts much later. Okay. In general, Dupuy was an engineer interested in the costs and benefits of public works. So he had to calculate cost and benefits of building a bridge, opening a channel, making a road. And he had to justify cost and benefits of this decision. However, his writings published in the second half of his life deal with subjects that go well beyond these topics. So in the second part of his life, he was an economist, not anymore an engineer interested in economics. So the topics of the second part of his life concern political economy in a wide sense, the theory of value, the theory of population, the theory of rent, the theory of property rights, and the optimality of free competition and free trade. He was a strong supporter of free trade. In my view, what made his contribution very original is his status as an engineer in the service of the state. So he was the public servant, and simultaneously he had a strong faith in free market. So for a French public official of that period, the defense of the general interest was a mission. But at the same time, he tried not to contradict his opinion in favor of free market. Okay, Dupuy was a very strong supporter of free markets. Nevertheless, he was convinced that as the transport network is a monopoly, technically, the private monopolist could abuse of his position. So he realized that there are some areas in which there is not a correspondence between the private interest and the collective interest. And I think he could be very, he could pay attention to this because he had this double nature of being a public, at the service of the state. He was the state in his person, but at the same time, he was very much in favor of free trade, of free market, sorry. So he trusted the government, but he didn't want to, I mean, he was a free market economist, so this conflict is at the base of his originality.
That's really interesting. Thank you. I didn't know anything about Dupuy, so this is great. One thing that I want to go back to is this question of how the Italian marginalists are related to, say, other schools of thought. And I picked up particularly on Marshall that I've read a little bit of. And so, for instance, Pareto was really unhappy at being compared to Marshall, but there are some things that they share. They're thinking about the dynamics of the economy. And eventually, Marshall is himself doubtful of some of the things that he says in Principle of Economics, that all, you know, introductory classes in economics, you know, convey with the supply demand diagrams, but he intended and did comment some more in industry and trade on, for instance, firms, given some developments such as joint stock companies. And so do you think of the Italian marginalists, for instance, insofar as they're related to someone like, to people like the British marginalists, do they provide a corrective story? Are they doing something else? How should we think of their relation?
The question is very difficult, but what can I can tell you the way in which the Italian marginalist interpreted Marshall and used the Marshallian tools. Maybe this can be a point of departure to answer this difficult question. So, as you said, when Pantaleoni compared Marshall to Pareto, he aroused the anger of the latter. But except for Pareto, Marshall was a solid reference point for the four Italians. Pantaleoni and De Viti had read Marshall carefully and quoted him extensively as early as 1889, so before the publication of the Principles. The correspondence between Pantaleoni and Barone is full of references to Marshall's work. Their elaboration to the question of natural monopoly and of large business, big business, owe a great deal to Marshall. For example, the Marshallian's idea of competition as the racing of one person against another, maybe it was this idea that prompted Pantaleoni's 1892 paper on competition as an horse race. There is a famous essay of Pantaleoni that describe competition as an horse race. And Pantaleoni was certainly influenced by Marshall's evolutionary concept of competition. But the most important in this reconstruction is Barone. Barone was Marshallian in a sense, as he found the Marshallian analysis more appropriate in describing the transitory period from one equilibrium to another. So he was a general equilibrium economist, but in this particular explanation in the description of the transitory period from one equilibrium to another, he used Marshall. He thought that the Varajian method is of no use for studying the adjustment path, since it jumps to the new equilibrium without considering the intricate series of intermediary steps from one equilibrium to another, without considering the slowness in the propagation of a shock. So Barone mainly uses the word dynamics exactly to indicate the analysis of the slow movement toward equilibrium. And in dealing with this case, he abandons the general equilibrium approach in favor of Marshall's partial equilibrium analysis. Actually, Barone wrote to Wicksell that he did his best to reconcile Walras, Marshall, and Edgeworth. So it's not an answer to your question, but I mean, I hope you find this satisfying.
Interesting nonetheless. So there is. I have one or two questions on how you approach writing history. And one of the things that's really wonderful about your book and these journal articles that you shared with us is that you managed to integrate the history of specific economic ideas and theoretical developments alongside concerns about the concurrent social and political context. And even each on its own is already really hard. And so I was wondering, how do you do it? And within the discipline, how often do they do it? Do they do it well enough? Or do you have feelings about this kind of, this way of writing history as being sensitive to both of these features?
So I decided to follow the criterion of placing importance on what was relevant for the economist I examined. So I started from a basis of history of analysis, that is from their pure economics. That was the base. And one of the aims of my book was precisely to expand the existing awareness of how extraordinarily rich and innovative their theoretical contribution was. However, I decided not to limit my analysis to the reconstruction and interpretation of their abstract theories. I treated the ideal and political value conveyed by these theories as an integral part of the study. In the specific case of the Italian marginalist, these external aspects were not only present, but also pervasive and often dominant. So another aim of my book was to make an in-depth reconstruction of the historical and political context in which their theories were generated, also focusing on the way they have been applied. And this corresponds to my belief that reconstructing exclusively internal history could give the impression that these four economists wrote only for the sake of the advancement of the economic analysis. And this is not true at all. I am convinced that it is only a well-contextualized approach that enables us to know the aims those theories want to achieve. And also they provides a key to understanding theoretical passages that are difficult to interpret. For example, think of the Ministry of Production in the Collectivist State by Barone, 1908. And this essay, this article, could be interpreted as being in favor of economic planning. But the reality is that its author had the political position strongly against socialism. So he wanted to demonstrate that it is logically possible, but actually impossible. So if you don't know his political idea, his vision, his ideology, you can just think that he was in favor of economic planning. And this is just an example. So in my book, I also discussed the nature of the four marginalists as applied economists. And it is equally authentic. So I scrutinized their writings in search of the relationship between theory and applications. And I found that this shift from abstract analysis to real world issues was indispensable in my analysis for grasping the essence of their ideas, including the ideas on pure economics. So I looked at the historical events of their age, linking them to the development of their ideas and to the effort to understand how reality works. And not only, but they were politically committed. They wanted their analysis to serve to explain the phenomena also outside the boundaries of economic realm. So I examined what operative importance they attributed to their theories on competition and monopoly power in some practical situation in which they used them. And this is so interesting because I analyzed not only economic issues, but also social and political, such as gender issues, the labor market, socialism, and the Great War. So they used the concept of competition and monopoly power in analyzing these four issues.
The next couple of questions I have are more forward-looking. So what you've done in your book and in these other writings is a lot of us have heard about Pareto, but we have these three other Italian marginalists who occupy little of the space in the secondary literature, but we should be aware of them. And you note Baroni, for instance, is someone that contributed really heavily to the theory of competition. So how should we now rethink the history that we thought we knew, given that you filled in this gap? We should do more than just give them some credit. So how do you see the legacy of having written this history for a public audience now?
If I well understood, your question is about why it was important to identify the place occupied by the Italian economists in the development of the idea of market power. In other words, what makes this question a good historical question? And I have several times stated in my book that there are no studies on this subject. The suspicion may arise that if this history has not yet been written, it is because it's not important. But I have tried to show why I think it is important. Finding the causes of monopoly power is as useful as finding entry barriers, as I said. The reason why it is important to know the sources of monopoly power is the same as why it is important to know what entry barriers are. Both allow us to understand why some firms are able to set prices above cost. Historiography has not dealt with the answers that were given to this question in the years before the studies of Bain and of Silo Slabini in the early 1950s. So in the book, I have seen that in fact, from the marginalist stage onwards, there was a great deal of thinking on the question of entry. What was lacking, therefore, before Bain and Silo Slabini was only the formal treatment of entry. So we come back to the point of formal versus verbal, no? It was only in formal models, not in theory, that this subject was not considered. So my study serves to avoid erasing from historical memory a huge chunk of theoretical thinking that is not mentioned in the history of the models, because there are not models, I mean formalized. It is now possible with my book to reject clearly and definitely the widespread myth that up until the 30s in economic theory, only the two extreme situations of perfect competition and monopoly were considered. You can find this statement in many books that it is new to consider the intermediate position between competition and monopoly, the two limit cases. It is not new at all. On the contrary, the economists were well aware of the hybrid situations and worked out theories to explain them. In the literature, there are numerous, if sometimes vague, references to this awareness. So the theoretical category of market power enabled me to demonstrate, I hope clearly, that even if not formalized in a model, a theory of a situation in which firms do have market power did in fact exist. And so in my book, I have written for the first time the Italian part of the neglected history of barriers to entry before Jobbain. The notion of entry barriers is also important for its implication for microeconomic policy. If there are causes of market power that bring about inefficiency, and if it is not a short-run phenomenon, then it is necessary for the government to intervene. And in order to identify these causes, theory is required. So the singling out of entry barriers is therefore the theoretical premise to the call for public intervention. And this was also so before Bain, even though the causes of monopoly power were not yet called entry barriers. The four marginalists wrote with the aim of influencing economic policy, and they did that in person. Since there was a correspondence between the reform proposals put forward by them and the explanation they gave to the phenomenon of market power, then the marginalist age should be considered the age when, for the first time, and not only in the United States, the ideas of the non-legal, non-institutional causes of market power formed the theoretical basis for competition policies. My study, therefore, I think, serves to afford proper recognition to those contributions that are not mentioned in the history of competition policies. The explanation of monopoly power, I think it is crucial now as it was then. The Italian marginalist made extensive use of this notion as a means of interpreting reality and intervening in it. Today, this category is even used to contrast two different visions of the world. One focused on competitiveness, the other focused on what gives rise to power, how it is maintained and strengthened. So investigating an era through a category that has never been applied to it means, I hope, shedding light on something that is not known or something that is not has not been seen yet.
That's related to, this is my very last question, which is that given this history, now we have a better sense of competition and monopoly as these multifaceted concepts themselves with this complicated historical background. And the thing that I wanted to ask was given these theoretical advancements, perhaps we should rethink how we think about competition and monopoly now, and other associated concepts in the vicinity like barriers to entry. And my guess is your answer is yes, we should rethink the way we think those about those. Does that seem about right?
I agree, I totally agree. And I answered this question taking the example of natural monopoly, no? The technical monopoly. In microeconomics, industrial organization, and public economics textbooks, the theory of natural monopoly describes a market in which, for, as I said, technical structural reasons, only one firm finds it profitable to produce. Until the end of the 1970s, natural monopoly was considered to occur in cases where economies of scale exist over the entire range of market demand. In this literature, scale economies are attributed to high fixed cost and low or zero variable costs. And scale economies are also considered a barrier to entry. Due to the monopoly power derived from them, natural monopoly is seen as a market failure, and government intervention is required in the form of nationalization, regulation, or antitrust. As natural monopoly depends upon the technology employed, technological innovations can open it to competition and again eliminate it. This theory has been criticized. The most influential criticism came from the theory of contestable markets, and they caused a radical change in the definition of natural monopoly. The policy implications of the theory of contestable market are that monopoly has no damaging effect, and there is no need for government intervention. The theory of contestable market is not the only source of criticism of the notion of natural monopoly. The followers of the Austrian school, for example, do not find anything wrong in monopolies. While for the Chicago school, market power is only temporary. Some other researchers deny the empirical relevance of the concept or narrow the limits of its use as a rationale for public intervention, like those that indicate even in the infrastructure segment of utility industry, where the characteristic of natural monopoly is not eliminable. Even there, competition could improve social welfare, or like those that claim that monopoly created by strong network economies is very fragile because of the particularly innovative character of that industry, and so on. So I don't know if the concept of natural monopoly will really be expelled from economic theory or not. But I think that its elaboration had required a great effort from the best of the economists of the past, and that before its alleged disappearance, it was worthwhile to reconstruct its history. So this historical reconstruction can also be seen as provocative for the new developments that deny the importance of natural monopoly. So for these developments that wish to toll the funeral bells for the notion of natural monopoly, I think this historical reconstruction can be provocative. So I agree.
And Carlos has been waiting so patiently. So I will pass on the mic to him.
Yeah, finally my turn. Thank you for all the interesting discussion so far, Manuela. To me, one of the most interesting aspects of your research is that you're often exploring the intersection between economics and politics. You have already touched on this question when answering one of Jen's questions earlier, but I wanted to hear some more from you on this point. You have recently edited, for instance, a collection of essays entitled Power in Economic Thought. We often hear complaints about how economists typically ignore power relations and how these relations can influence the economic processes and outcomes they study. But of course, tackling this huge topic is much easier said than done. Could you tell us a bit about the vision and the approach that you brought to bear when editing this volume?
Yes, I found that in every decade, various economists belonging to different schools of thought have lamented the lack of the concept of power within economic science. And I have suggested various ways of, they have suggested various ways of introducing it. And at the same time, they seem to be nostalgic for an era in which power was an integral part of the discipline. However, their reference to economists of the past are brief and infrequent and not particularly focused on the link between economics and power. So what I made was an overview of how this concept has been employed in the various domains in which it was found helpful and how it was brought into economic theory by economists of different orientation. My book on power is structured around four broad areas. The first part considers the way economists have handled the issue of political power, from authoritarian to democratic forms. So the first part analyzes the theories they elaborated to place limits both to the arbitrary power of the sovereign and on that of political institution also in democratic regimes. The second part examines the way economists have tackled the asymmetries of economic power associated with inequality of income. So here a concept of class entered the analysis. The third part focuses on market power of large firms. We have discussed a lot on this. And the fourth and last part concerns the power of economists in the role of both policymakers and experts and compares their different visions of how to manage a market economy. Now, in my introduction, in order to directly verify whether or not the category of power is present or not in contemporary economic theory, I made a search in three mainstream economic journals for articles that in the last 20 years used the word power in a title. And despite the limited size of my sample, I found a large number of articles. And I also found that their treatment of power falls into the same four broad areas mentioned above. So I realized that there is a certain overlapping between them, but there are also important differences. And the most important difference is that the second category, the asymmetries of economic power associated with inequality of income, is not the same. So the power of the wealthiest class has gone out of the picture and became a heterodox theme, became a heterodox issue. Nowadays, this category concerns the analysis of collective decision-making in private economic institutions, the power of the leaders, the power of private authorities. It also includes the analysis of labor markets, the economics of gender, and of minorities. So here, nowadays, the power considered in this second category is based on the hypothesis of rationality of economic agents. So the concept of class is gone. And this is the approach adopted in the entry power in the new Palgrave Dictionary of Economics. And the entry power was included for the first time since its first publication in 2008 by Bowles and Gintis. They are Marxist, but they use this hypothesis of rationality of economic agents. So it is an individualistic approach.
So you were a student of the marginal revolution, which is often blamed by its critics for having purged economics of any political considerations, or at least of any explicit political considerations. Do you think this is a fair assessment?
Not in my case, not in this case. As I said, along with their scientific work, the Italian marginalists showed a lively, lasting interest in politics, which led to a considerable amount of publicist writings, as well as to active militancy. Davide De Marco was an MP for almost 20 years. Pantaleoni was elected to parliament for 4 years, only 4 years. Pareto, as I said, unsuccessfully attempted the political career twice, and Barone too stood in vain for election. As I said, the events of the Italian political history were strongly felt and debated by these economists and had a deep impact on their writings. They started out from radical liberal positions, an initial faith in the development of democracy, and even an alliance with the socialist reformists in support of the free market and free trade as part of a general process of moral regeneration of Italian politics. This prospect, however, turned out to be short-lived. After a while, Pantaleoni became a nationalist, but remained essentially loyal to the ideal of an intensely socially selective political system. His concept of democracy as competition, open to all classes of society, had a strong anti-socialist connotations and made it easy for him to support the early stages of fascism. At the end of the century, Pareto became profoundly skeptical. He regarded the democratic regimes as highly dynamic systems, profoundly unstable, and in general, and particularly in the case of Italy, destined to be short-lived. Especially in his treatise on general sociology, he tried to maintain the attitude of a purely detached, objective scholar, though clearly not a sympathizer with democracy. Barone was aware of the fact that none of his models of the state was realizable in practice. Neither the planned economy nor the private property market economy with a minimum role for an enlightened government. De Viti alone preserved his original faith in democracy. Parallel to the idealized view of democracy as cooperation among a class of rulers and the class of ruled, he presented in his political works a realistic vision of the political processes. Pessimism gradually gained the upper hand, but it never made him give up his early vision, at least as a theoretical construction. De Viti De Marco, unlike Pareto, always had in mind the reference point of an ideal world, but he was also aware that reality was different. He believed that in theory, the action of the state was a means of overcoming the disparity between the ideal and the practical, but at the same time, he did his utmost to oppose the tendency he found in governments to cause further distortion. What I mean with this answer is that they were marginalist, but as you can see, their political considerations were very present to them, very important for them.
And speaking of De Viti De Marco, in a recent paper co-authored with Francesco Martelloni, you have explored how he strongly advocated in favor of Woodrow Wilson's liberal internationalism during the time of World War I. What does this example might tell us about this relationship between marginalist economic theory and political ideology more generally?
As for the relationship between economic theory and political ideology, maybe it can be useful to show the differences among the four economists on the ideological plane. Initially, there was a great affinity in their position, and their battle was a joint effort. They interpreted marginalism as the theoretical foundation of their free market and free trade orientation, and they believed that they could influence culture and politics. Then their positions began to diverge. Pantaleoni's hope lay in the progressive strengths of the bourgeoisie. So for him, the ideal state should be minimal and in the hands of the selected elite, and therefore keen on competition, governing an electorate which is also selected and in turn ready to compete to govern. However, Pantaleoni observes that the extension of suffrage induces parliamentarians to look for votes in the mass of losers, about whom there are endless insults. They fear selection and hinder progress, but they receive favors and privileges from the state. So he considers it useful, right, and proper to try to provide the ruling class with some leadership. It is clear that Pantaleoni's liberalism has a strong elitist streak. And as a result, in his work, there is a constant aspect of coercion. The elite must keep society competitive. Pareto, on the other hand, views with disenchantment the rise and fall of the elites and the role played by government. And he ended up having very little faith in economic policy, in spite of his initial free market and free trade orientation. Don't forget that in the meanwhile, Pareto developed his sociology, so the economic aspect was relegated in a small realm in the meanwhile. So he didn't believe anymore in the efficacy of the economic policies. Barone also wants a minimal state, enlightened, thanks to the substitution of the members of the elite. You see, there is this theory of the circulation of elite in all of them. So the substitution of the elite And he wanted to guarantee the condition for competition and to guide the economy when necessary. In him, in Barone, there is neither Pantaleoni's anti-statism nor Pareto pessimism. He was very pragmatic, Pantaleoni. By contrast, De Viti De Marco was a liberal reformer. He believed in the ideal of a democratic of a democracy with the political forces alternating in power. From the point of view of economic policies, he believed that legislation could, in principles, be the way to intervene in the economy. But he too, over time, lost faith in the real possibility of educating the masses to a political competition. The ideal of all four economists was a constantly renewed elite that would impose a minimal state, because in different degrees they were all afraid that monopoly power was created rather than prevented or remedied by government intervention. So they were skeptical. They were skeptical with respect to the government activity. So at the end of the progressively, there were profound differences among the Italian marginalists on the political plane. Pantaleoni and Barone became nationalist, and De Viti was against nationalism. The cultural models they took as reference point were different. I have in the book emphasized the Anglo-Saxon inspiration and anti-German feeling marking the thought of De Viti and Pantaleoni. In contrast, Barone was a great admirer of Germany. I have also shown the differences between Pareto and De Viti on the role of intellectuals in society, and between Pantaleoni and De Viti on the class that should take on the ruling role, and so on. The relationship between marginalist economic theory and political ideology is very complex and articulate.
That's great stuff, and it dovetails quite nicely with the little I know of the interwar period, which also points to this sort of multiple combinatorial possibilities of economic and political convictions. So that's greatly appreciated. Let me conclude by bringing the conversation a little bit closer to some current trends. Interest in political economy, both among lay and scholarly audiences, seems to have been growing for a while. Even if the meaning attributed to the concept itself, political economy, remains quite loose and diverse, the phrase is now much more common in the everyday jargon of economists, historians, and even social scientists more generally. Do you see this as a reversal of some of the trends that dominated economics during most of the 20th century?
More than a reversal, I see a revival of interest. Political economics emerged in the mid-1980s, but this discipline deals with the same topic as public choice, more or less. That is to say, with economic models for political analysis. In other words, it extends economic analysis to government decision. James Buchanan, the founder of public choice in the early 1950s, was strongly influenced by the Italian marginalists. The attitude of the Italian marginalist that was reflected in their political thought bears the imprint of a typical Italian tradition of political realism, which dates back to Machiavelli. So while they were working on renewing the discipline of public finance, the Italian economist also included elements of political science within the area of public finance. In fact, by paying explicit attention to the institutional system and employing the tools typical to economic analysis to examine it, they find themselves also inquiring into the processes of political decision with those same instruments. So, if today we see public choice as a discipline at the intersection between economics and political science, in that era, its topics were included in public finance. So the border was wider, And so it was dealt with using the categories of economic science. In other words, the link between public choice and the public finance tradition in the historical perspective is mainly due to the fact that at the very beginning, this new discipline included a preliminary attempt to formulate an economic model of the state. And this is especially true for De Viti De Marco. So more than a reversal, I can see a revival of interest. As I show in my book, they were very much interested. And now it is sort of a reinterpretation of their theories.
Manuela, this has been wonderful. Your answers have been so detailed and so, you know, this is exactly what we're looking for in this kind of an interview. So we really appreciate you joining us, and we appreciate your thoughtfulness in addressing our questions. And,
thank you so much for joining us. This was great.
Thank you, Manuela. That was wonderful. Thank you for your questions, and thank you for inviting me.
Join us again next month for another episode of Smith & Marks Walk Into a Bar, the History of Economics podcast. Smith & Marks Walk Into a Bar is generously supported by a grant from the History of Economics Society New Initiatives Fund. For more information about the Society, please visit historyofeconomics.org.